Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. We're showing how Shabda Pramana is superior to the other Pramans. It's at least Shabda Pramana coming from perfect authority is infallible. Jiva Goswami, at the beginning of this comment on text 9, listed several special qualities of Shabda Pramana. What we're doing now, he's going into detail about each one and giving examples. I'll go back to the original list of features. First of all, the other pramanas are tainted by human faults of judgment, and therefore you can never be sure if they're reliable. Shabda is not like that. The Shabda is free from the influence of those faults. Shabda Praman apaudasheya. Shabda Praman which doesn't have an author, and therefore doesn't have an imperfection of ordinary authors. The others are dependent on Shabda, like the servants of a king. But Shabda is independent, doesn't depend on anything else. The others can sometimes assist Shabda Praman. On the other hand, Shabda Praman is independent and is often seen to overrule other Pramanas. When Shabda Praman establishes something as fact, then other Pramans cannot deny it. But Shabda alone is able to reveal things that other Pramans are incapable of revealing. Basically, that's the list. Now we're dealing with the fact that it's independent, or it's not dependent on anything else. Shabdasya tu nairapekshyam. Shabda has no dependence on any other pramana. Yata dashamas tvam asit ya dao sa esha shabdo dashamo ham asmi iti pramayas tiraskarinam moham shravanapata pravesha matrad vinivartayati evaiti spashtam eva nairapekshyam Atma-shakti-anurupam-eva pratyakshena shabdasya sachivya kritihi yata agnir-himasya-beshajam ityadau eva natu bhavan babuva garbe me matura nagare suta ityadau. Verbal testimony is different. It does not depend on the other means. Take, for example, the statement, you are the tenth. There's a story. I can't remember. I only know it's in a comic book. I don't remember where it's really from. Some Upanishad, someplace. If anybody knows, let me know. I want to reference it, but I don't know where it comes from. You are the tenth. The story is that the guru is sort of helping the disciple realize that he doesn't understand everything properly. He says, okay, look around you. How many people do you see? How many people are here? And he looks and sees nine people. He says, nine. And the guru says, no, you're wrong. And the reason is you are the tenth. You didn't count yourself. I don't know where that comes from. If anybody can help me find it, please. As soon as this verbal testimony enters the path of one's ears, it dispels any confusion that might be obscuring the right understanding that I am the tenth. Obviously, any confusion it might be obscuring. Well, okay, the confusion is he's just looking outside, counting the bodies he sees. He doesn't see his own body. He doesn't count himself. There's confusion. But that's corrected by the Shabda Praman, the guru's opinion. You're wrong. No, there are 10 people, including you. Obviously, the statement is independent. The statement, you are the 10th. Sensory perception assists verbal testimony. Now we get to the next feature that makes Shabda Praman superior. That it takes assistance from the other pramanas as suitable. That means it's not always suitable. Sometimes it takes assistance, and sometimes they can't do anything to assist the other pramanas. So sensory perception assists verbal testimony only so far as it can. For example, in statements such as fire counteracts ice. Somewhere in the Vedas it says that. Now, we believe it because the Vedas say so. But also, we have experience of it. We can do a laboratory experiment. Take a chunk of ice and expose it to fire, it'll melt the ice. We can see it for ourselves. So in that case, our perception does assist the primary authority of Shabda. It cannot help, however, in a statement such as, "My son, you were in my womb in the city of Mathura." Your mother tells you that, if you were born in Mathura. But you can't verify it empirically. You just have to believe your mother. The authoritative statement that fire melts ice is valid whether it convinces the hearer or not. You may not believe it. You may not be prone. You may not be inclined to accept it just because the Vedas say so, because you don't believe the Vedas. So you don't believe the authoritative statement. You don't take it as authoritative, the Vedas statement that fire melts ice. But it does, whether you believe it or not. All the propositions made in the Vedas are true, whether you understand them, whether you believe and agree in them or not. But actually seeing fire melt ice certainly helps support the statement. Many situations, however, cannot be understood by direct perception alone. No one can go back in the past and witness himself as an embryo in the womb. Okay, next section. Next feature of Shabda. Shabdasya tu tad upamardakatvam. Shabda overrules other pramanas. It doesn't mean it always does. It's not that everything we see is wrong and the Vedas tell us something opposite to everything we see. That's not the fact. But there are some things that we think we see that are wrong and the Vedas correct it. We think that bones are dirty. Actually, we're told that by the Shastras. But then we get a conch shell and told it's not dirty. Well, the Vedas will tell us conch shells are clean, even though they're bones. Anyway, example he gives, yata sarpa dashte twayi visham nasti iti mantra ityadau tena pratipadite pratyaksha virodi tvam. And pratyaksha cannot contradict what's been established by Shabda. Yata suvarnam basitam snigdam ityadau. Tasyaiva tu sadaka tamatvam yata. And Shabda is the most effective praman. Most effective means of knowing. Yata graha chesht adav iti. Sarva vadyaksha siddham yat tat satyam ityesha pakshak sarvasyaikatra milena asambhavat parahataha. Ata bahunam pratyaksha siddham ityesho pi kvachid deshe paurusheya shastre va kasyapi vastuno anyata jnana darshanat parahataha. Verbal testimony, moreover, can overrule sensory perception, as in the mantra, "You have been bitten by a snake, but now the poison is no longer in your system." The person is feeling the poison. The doctor has chanted the mantra. This is not just the doctor talking his own words. This is a mantra that he's chanting, that he's learned. It's part of the mantra cure. There are such mantras in the Garuda Purana for curing snake bites. So the mantra is recited. It says there's no more poison in you, even though you were bit by the snake. And it's going to be true. It may take a few minutes before the person experiences it, but it's established fact. Continuing, when verbal testimony establishes a fact, as in such a statement as, "When gold is ingested, it becomes oily," sensory perception cannot contradict it. This is Ayurveda. Gold is sometimes used in some medicines. Makes them more potent, but more expensive. Things have tastes. There are six tastes and combinations of them. And things that are eaten or taken as medicine have, beside taste, number of other qualities like dryness, hotness, roughness, smoothness, oiliness. Different substances have different perceivable qualities. But there's the quality that that's experienced when you first put something in your mouth, and then the substance becomes digested, it undergoes chemical change, and the qualities can change. Lemon is sour in the mouth, but when digested, it becomes sweet. Gold is not oily. If you put a piece of gold in your mouth, it doesn't taste oily. But when you digest, you don't take a whole lump. If you digest some gold powder in your medicine, it will become oily after being digested. And we know that from the Shastra. I don't think this is the Rig Veda. I don't have a source, but it's probably one of the Ayurvedic texts Jiva Goswami is quoting. I don't think we're going to find a reference to that anyway, but we take it from the authority of the Shastra. We don't have direct perception of it. Or, no, that's not the point here. Is that whatever we perceive isn't going to contradict it. I may say, no, gold is not oily. I tasted it. It's not oily. But the Ayurveda says it becomes oily. And that's authoritative, no matter what you think you perceive. Verbal testimony alone is the most effective means of knowing something like the influence of the planets. Well, most effective. Influence of the planets. No, I think this is movement of the planets. I think we got it wrong.
Something
like. It's graha cheshta and other things. Not other things about the grahas, but other things in general. Other things that are most effectively known through Shabda. Now, Graha Cheshta, Cheshta is movement, I think, movement of the planets. Now, you can yourself look, use your telescope and your trigonometry and, you know, and measure the movements of all the planets. But that'd be quite a tedious thing to do. And it's been done over the centuries by astronomers. They've compiled ephemerises, books that you can look up where the planets are going to be. They've developed mathematical formulas for predicting where they're going to be. And they use those formulas, now they use computers, to generate tables that you can look up, or even a program that will tell you where such and such planet's going to be at a certain time. You could use, that's authority. The ephemeris is the authority on the position of the planets. Ephemeris, the book with the, that tells you where the planets are at a certain time. You could use your projection instead, but it would be quite tedious. You know, you'd have to every night just take a look in the sky and see where they are. And you're not going to be able to predict the future because you can't see it yet. You could record the past, you could look at the present, but it's limited and very tedious. So in this case, Shabda Praman is much more effective. All you have to do is flip the page, point at the point on the column, and you have the figures, and you just accept them. They've already been calculated by someone else, an authority. So Shabda can be more effective, but generally is more effective than other Pramans. I mean, it's more direct and easy. Just let someone tell you. Surrender to Krishna, chant Hare Krishna, and you'll be happy. Now, if you can just accept that, then your life is much improved. If you doubt it, and you need proof of it, and you need to, you know, establish it in this way and that way, that chanting Hare Krishna actually will make you happy, then it's a tedious process, and you may fail. You may, because you're not chanting the right way, you may remain unhappy and say, no, it doesn't work, it doesn't make me happy. So just accepting from authority is a much more effective process. The guru tells you, chant Hare Krishna, you'll be happy. Believe him, do it, and it'll work. Easy. More complicated to prove it for yourself. The opinion, this is, let's say, a purva paksha. The word paksha is there in the Sanskrit. The opinion that what all persons can perceive through their senses must be true. This is an attempt to show projection to be superior. All you have to do is, you can't depend on one person's projection. Just make a survey of what everybody sees. And if everybody sees it, it must be true. So the opinion that what all persons perceive through their senses must be true cannot be substantiated. Because to gather everyone together in one place is impossible. You can have that opinion, but you can't prove it. And the opinion, okay, if everybody saw the same thing, okay, it would be reliable. But there's no way to know that everyone's seeing the same thing. We assume that we're all seeing this table, you know, but maybe you're seeing a snake. You know, my computer's sitting on a snake. I'm thinking everyone's seeing a table, but I'm just assuming that. And the opinion that what many persons can perceive should be true cannot be accepted. Okay, can't find everybody, can't bring everybody together and get it and find out what everybody's seeing. How about if many people see it, then it should be true? That can't be accepted. Because we see that in some communities and in some authoritative texts written by human authors, certain matters are wrongly understood. So you can't propose should not propose that what many people think must be true, what many people perceive, because many people may be sharing the same misperception. You can have a whole community of people who all think the wrong, wrong perception. Or you can have a Shastra that's accepted by many people, that's been written by a human author, and is saying something wrong. And everybody who follows it believes it, but it's wrong. Okay, commentary on this. A victim of snake bite may still feel the pain of poison even after his curer has dispelled the power of the poison by chanting the proper mantra and has assured the victim the poison is leaving you. Despite the victim's doubt, however, the effective mantra will cure him. Actually, in Newsweek magazine from month of May, there was an article about pain. And the big problem is that even after, the nerve channels directed by the brain become sensitive to pain as the body's defense. It alerts us to a dangerous situation by making us feel pain. But what happens is the nerve channels reroute themselves in a painful circuit. And even after the cause of pain goes away, you often still feel the pain. You know, the injury has been cured, but you're still feeling it as if the injury is there. You feel the pain. Because the nerve channels are rerouted and they just remain stuck. And that's a big problem. How to this phantom pain, when there's no cause for the pain, you're still feeling it. So that's a modern finding, but actually Jiva Goswami is talking about that. The person who's been bitten by the snake has been the poison has been removed, but he's still feeling the poison. Okay. Or another example. For those who don't believe in such mantras, a more suitable example may be that of a medical doctor's assurance to a patient that the antidote being administered will cure him. In such cases, the mantra doctor and the medical doctor both have the power to authoritatively predict the cure. Gold and other precious metals and gems, ground into powder and further processed, are used therapeutically in Ayurvedic medicine. We have no empiric way of knowing that gold powder in Ayurvedic mixtures becomes oily when digested, but Ayurvedic texts affirm this. The positions of celestial bodies relative to the earth is calculable by anyone who knows the relevant mathematical formulas. But most astronomical observers prefer to locate the celestial bodies by using books of tables in which the calculations have already been made. In that case, Shabda Praman is more effective than retracing the steps of perception and inference. It's more effective than going through the whole tedious process for yourself. Okay, that is the comparison of specifically of Pratyaksha with Shabda Praman. Next he's going to deal with the comparison of Anuman, or logic, with Shabda. So before that, any questions or comments? But try to make it relevant to the discussion so we don't get way off on a tangent. Yeah.
In this case of movements of planets, so many people refer to the Western astrological tables, but those people, the astrological scientists who have calculated such exact movements of the planets and so on, so when people are referring to those Western tables, they are not exactly referring to Shabda Praman, but they are taking knowledge from a source which is a reliable source because those people have experimented and found out that. So yes. Can we say that is also a part of Shabda, even though it is not directly coming from
what
Veda?
What kind of Shabda?
That is those people, the astrological...
Yeah, what did you call it?
A kind of Shabda.
A kind of Shabda, yes. Because those
astronomers are reliable authorities about where the planets are. So it's Aptivakya. Not Apurusheya, not totally infallible. They can make mistakes because they're human beings. Sometimes scientists cheat. They say that they've tested everything when they haven't, or they ignore some of the results they don't like and misreport. Sometimes they cheat, or sometimes they make other mistakes. But if they're, you know, if they haven't done that, then they can be relied on.
So extending that to other fields of knowledge like medicine or astronomy or many other fields, science and technology, everywhere scientists have advanced to some extent. So their words, the common people are following. So can that also be said as a kind of a Shabda?
Because a kind of Shabda Praman, but fallible. Fallible. There's accepted opinion from authority, and it can be wrong. And very often, the next generation is proven wrong. And the way that science develops is that the only way you're going to change opinions is to wait for the old people with the old opinions to die, because they have power and influence, and they're stubborn. So you got to wait for them to die, and then you can replace with a better opinion. But it's fallible. Yes.
I'll get you next.
Talking about the comparison of pratyaksha and shabda, and it's a common question: where the border lies? For instance, we've oftentimes discussed how mukhya vritti has to be accepted as the first approach to interpreting the scripture. But if that contradicts some perceptible laws or perceptible facts, then it has to be taken as gauna vritti, like gange nagaram or something like that. But on the other hand, for instance, we have such statements by, say, Rupa Goswami in the Nectar of Devotion, that water drops from a particular rain, particular constellation, when they fall on heads of snakes, they turn into gems, and when they fall into ocean, they turn into pearls.
Yes.
So such things, do we take them as allegorical, or do we take them as factual, or where the border lies exactly? Because we might not even see how they contradict the laws of nature.
It depends on what the source of the statement is and what the purpose of it was. If it's just a poetical description, it may not have to be taken as literally true. Poets create artificial reality. A poet is like Lord Brahma. He makes his own creation. But it's a mental creation. The logic of his poetry world doesn't have to correspond to physical reality. So it may be a different reality, the reality of the poet's mind. If it's poetry, but if it's serious science, then it's supposed to be concrete fact. So if it's a statement in the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, about rasa and not a poetic example quoted, but actual part of the textbook, should be true, should be accepted as true. If it's coming from an authoritative source and it's meant to be, and he meant to you for to take it seriously, you should.
The reason for this question is that I have had.
But you have to interpret things, you know. If your guru says you're a jackass, it doesn't mean that you stop, you know, you have to stop being a human being and start walking on 4 feet. Yeah. You know, you have to understand it, you know, in the proper what he actually meant by that.
Because oftentimes people have a hard time accepting Vedas, not because of their metaphysical statements. They may even believe about statements that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God and there is a spirit soul which transmigrates.
Yes.
But when it comes to Vedas claims and statements about physical reality around us, especially planets and especially such physical facts as rainwater turning into gems, and then they have a hard time accepting.
If you actually accept the authority of the Vedas, if you have strong faith in the Vedas, if you're an astika, if you really believe in the Vedas, you should accept those statements. even the ones that are strange and seem to contradict your experience. And if you don't, then your faith is weak. And that's a test of your faith.
But as you explained, it takes knowing where the statements are supposed to be interpreted as scientific or merely allegorical.
That's what you have a guru for. That's what you have gurus for.
But for instance,
to help you interpret.
The example of Gangayam.
Gangayam.
Gangayam. Gangayam, right.
Then Goshaha.
Yeah, Gosham. Then we may interpret it away, as allegorical, even though we may not know so there is some particular sage who blessed a particular village which started floating on the waters of the Ganges, for instance.
But it's not supposed to mean that.
It's not supposed to.
That usage is the standard textbooks on logic and on poetry give that as an example of a figurative lakshana usage, intentionally so, to express a certain idea about the village. So it's the author intended it not to be literal. When he said there's a village on the Ganga, he meant there's a village on the shore. And what effect you get from, what suggestion you get from hearing that, is that just as the Ganga itself is so pure, and the environment around it is cool, so also the village is sanctified and cool. That's suggested. So that's all intended by the author. He didn't mean to say that there's a village floating on top of the water. So proper understanding of Shabda is to understand what the author meant to say by his statement, not turn it into something else.
So it requires very thorough investigation of the context of a particular statement, right? In other words...
Well, you can do a lot of investigating, or you can just ask somebody who knows better. Ask somebody who knows what it means, and he can tell you in 1 minute.
I mean by that, by investigation, I mean asking proper people.
Because we might ask the proper people.
Is it jump too fast, too soon to the conclusion it's all factual, or we also jump to the conclusion it's all allegorical, one of the two, and both could be mistaken?
Yes. Well, okay. You know, like in the Bhagavatam, I don't think you'll find many allegories. You have the story of Paranjana. You have another story that Narada told to the Pachetas. Hariyashras, the sons of Daksha. And that's it. There's maybe two or three, four allegories. Everything else is literal history. At least in the Bhagavatam. Yeah, story, but it was told as a story. All of them were intentionally, were openly meant to be taken as allegories. Everything else is history in the Bhagavatam. Okay, yes, sir. Go ahead, and then we still have to get to Gopal.
This example he mentioned, in the commentary, Jiva Goswami mentions the four clear examples that in the rain
hold it close.
When the rain falls from the Swadhi Nakshatra, then the particular kind of a deer, so when its belly, then it produces a fragrant substance. So there are four examples like that it's given. And in India, especially in South, everybody knows about these four. It's a very common thing. It's called, we call it Kasturi Man. Man means a deer, and a Kasturi Man is a special type of deer which produces a substance called Kasturi.
Yes.
When the rain from that particular constellation falls. Similarly, Gorochana is the second thing. When the on the feet of the cows, when the rain falls from particular nakshatra, then it produces a fragrant yellow color substance which is also used for decorating Krishna's face. So Gorochana. Similarly, Gajamani and also oyster produces pearl. So these are very common substances which most of us, we are familiar in South at least. So
yes.
Like that, most of the things are seen clearly. May not be known maybe to Western people, but here it is very clearly known.
Yes. Thank you. So,
I just want to make it clear, there's these five features I've noted down of Shabda. It's Apova Shreya, it's independent, sometimes assisted, overrules and it's more effective. So these are all in relation.
And also, it can reveal things that other pramans cannot.
Okay, yes. I can't include that more effective.
Okay. No, it's separate.
Okay. So all this is versus pratyaksha?
No, versus all the other pramanas. We've only dealt with pratyaksha so far.
Okay, with the nanu. Well, he was describing the nanu, understand? The purvapaksha?
But this whole discussion has been, there's been a lengthy discussion about
pratyaksha. Okay. But all of these applies to all of them, but we've just been dealing
well,
with
especially pratyaksha.
Comparing with pratyaksha, okay.
Especially pratyaksha.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I think we continue. Go ahead.
It's a small point. For example, if you have this question of Gauna Mukhya Vritti or some statement of Shabda and we approach to different authorities and they give us different interpretation of this.
Yes.
So what to do in this case? Because we cannot judge it ourselves and their opinion also differ. So which one we should accept and what we should do?
I'm sorry, different opinions? What different opinions?
Yeah, we approach to different authority and then interpret this statement of Shastra.
Well, we have to have a priority among our authorities. We have to have somebody who we accept as first authority. Because different people will give you different opinions. Therefore, you accept someone as your ultimate authority. Usually Diksha Guru should be, you know, when there's different opinions coming from different people you accept as authority, you go to the Diksha Guru to get his opinion and that settles it. Yeah. Bhagavatapu.
I want to ask one question about the Shabda Pramana and Pratyaksha and Shabda.
Yes.
Before you mentioned that the Shabda is actually based on the Pratyaksha of the wise. Is it something like that? This mean whatever.
Well, okay, but that has to be understood properly. It doesn't mean that Shabda is dependent on it or that it's created from. It just means we know. Okay, Shabda exists no matter whether anybody knows it or talks about it. Even if nobody ever read the Vedas, and nobody ever taught the Vedas are there, and they're absolutely true. They're not dependent on any wise man's perception or anybody's perception. What's dependent is our understanding of the Shabda. We cannot understand the Shabda. We cannot get in contact with the Shabda without wise people guiding us. So it's our perception of the Shabda that's dependent on the wise people.
Thank you.
Is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, we continue. Atta pratigya het udarana opanayana Nigamabhida panchangam. I'm not allowed to break the words up. Anumanam yattadapi vyabhicharati. Tatra vishama vyaptau yata. Vishya tatkala nirvapita vaknau chiram. Adikotitvara dume parvate parvato yam vakniman itya dao. Varshasu. Dumayamana sobhave parvate va. Natu shabda, yata suryakantat saura marichi yogena agnir uttishtate ityatra. Well, okay. This is a little concise. I try to clarify some of it in the commentary, so wait till we get through the commentary before getting confused. Here we're going to show what's fallible about inference or logic, called anuman. Next, we consider how logical inference, consisting of five parts, hypothesis, evidence, exemplification, application, and conclusion also tends to deviate, especially when facts are inconsistent. For example, a tall pillar of smoke may gather on a mountain for some time after rain has extinguished the fire. Or a mountain may appear smoky on its own during the rainy season. Verbal testimony, however, is reliable, as in the statement, fire arises from a Suryakanta stone when in contact with the rays of the sun. Now, let me read the commentary to try to clarify this. We talked about five steps in a logical argument. This is from Nyaya, from Gautama Rishi's sutras. It's not that every logical argument or all logical reasoning has to exactly follow this pattern. This is the standard pattern when you want, it's called Pararta Anuman. When you're presenting a logical explanation for somebody else, then you should follow this five-step procedure systematically and including all the steps. When you're figuring something out for yourself, you can skip over steps. You can use a simpler process and jump to a conclusion. But it should be all spelled out when you're arguing to convince somebody else. These are the five steps. Commentary. The Nyaya school of philosophy deals elaborately with the topic of anuman, or logical inference. The Nyaya sutras don't deal only with anuman. They deal with all kinds of pramans, including pratyaksha and shabda, mainly. I think the Nyaya school recognizes a fourth one. What do you call it? Analogy. Upamana. Yeah, they recognize four. But they focus mostly on anuman. The school recommends that one use a five-step formal procedure when trying to persuade others by logical argument. First, one should state what one intends to prove. For example, there is fire here. It should be specific. There should be identifying a certain place and time. There's something at that place and time. Not just some vague thing, but specific. Not here and now, such and such. So like, there is fire here. Second, one should give the evidence for the thesis, such as, because there is smoke. I don't see any fire, but I see smoke. And I take that as evidence that there's fire. Third, one should give the evidence for the third. One should state the reason as a general principle, with at least one real example. It's called udaharana, but actually it's not just giving an example. It's giving the general rule with an example, with at least one example. At least one real example, from actual experience. Positive or negative. So you can have a stronger argument would be to give both positive and negative. But in many situations, some situations you can't give both. You can only give a positive or a negative, but when you can give both, that's even stronger. For example, preferably both, for example, wherever there is smoke, there is fire. That's the general rule that you're stating. And then you give your examples. Like in the kitchen. There's smoke in the kitchen and there's fire in the kitchen. And unlike in the middle of a lake. Middle of a lake, there's no smoke and there's also no fire. Or there's no fire and there's also no smoke. So you give both a positive and negative example. Then you have a strong argument. Now, what's the authority of your general principle, your hetu? It's called a hetu. What is that based on? On what? Tradition. Because your grandmother said so? Did you say experience? But it has to be, this is called inference. It has to be repeated, gathered experience, a lot of experience. Like I see the sun rise every day of my life. And therefore I make a rule, the sun rises every day and it's going to arise tomorrow and the day after that too. Inference means collecting a lot of experience and then making a generalization. It's always been like this, it's probably going to be like that in the future too. It's never certain, never absolutely certain. It's just, you're still assuming that things aren't going to change. So an inference is never absolutely certain. Inference in the sense of collecting a lot of evidence and assuming it's going to be like that in other cases. It's still an assumption, not absolutely certain. It's not like deduction, where you have a mathematical formula that has to be true by definition. 1 + 1 = 2 by the definition of 1 and 2. It's not that tomorrow it might change. But tomorrow, I may not have considered everything that could happen, and tomorrow something that never happened before could happen and break my inference. Deduction is absolute, but inference is not. And all real science that deals with real things is based on inference. You collect a lot of information, a lot of data, and then you assume a general rule. But there's always a putting faith in it. You're never absolutely sure. So science is, that kind of concrete science is never absolutely sure. Anyway, that's called udaharana. It's two things. Stating your general principle, wherever there is smoke, there is fire. And then giving some examples. Like I can say, in modern logic, in Buddhist logic and in modern Western logic, I can say all square triangles are purple. There's no such thing as a square triangle. Triangles have three sides. There's never a four-sided triangle. But according to the rules of modern logic, an inference is wrong when... You say that A therefore B, if A is true and B is false, then the rule is wrong, is invalid. But if A is always false, then it doesn't matter whether B is true or false. When you're talking about square triangles, it's not logically invalid to say anything about them. All square triangles are purple is an acceptable logical statement. But not in Gotama's logic, not in the concrete logic of the Nyaya school. There, you have to pin down your logic. You have to bring it down to earth by giving a real example. All square triangles are purple. Well, give me an example. Then you can't do that. There's no example. Right? You can't give an example of a square triangle. You don't have any. So having to give an example forces you to make the logic concrete, down to earth. Yes, and not dealing with absurdities. Yes. So if the Buddhists try to argue that God is cruel, if the Buddhists argue that God is cruel, you can counter them by saying, for you, God, there is no God. The concept God is empty for you. You don't accept that there is a soul or anything persisting. So you don't accept that there is a God. For you, God is a square triangle. So you cannot prove anything about God. You have no right to talk about God because God is nothing to you. That's called upasiddhanta. They have an assumption that there is no God. Then you can't be arguing about what God is like. You can be dismissed from the debate because you've broken your own assumption. Yes, yeah. Actually, unless it's really relevant, maybe we should save it. Okay, but go ahead, but in general, better to wait till we stop for questions. Go ahead.
Okay. So, in the general principle, it should be an example. That's an inference or deduction?
Wait. The example is an inference?
So I'll give you an example where there's smoke, there's fire.
No, that's not an example. That's the general rule. That's the hetu. The general principle. And then you give an example. Like in the kitchen. The kitchen is the example. The kitchen is the example of a place where there is smoke and fire.
And that's always by...
No, I'm sorry, where there's fire and there's also smoke. Wherever there's smoke, there's fire. So you got smoke in the kitchen, and there's always fire there too.
And that's inference or deduction?
That's neither. The principle, wherever there is smoke, there is fire, that's derived by inference. By having seen a lot of cases of such, you say, okay, it must always be like that, and you make a rule. The rule is based on inference. The example has nothing to do with... example is just one case. You know, an inference or a logic tries to generalize. But this is a specific statement. In the kitchen, there's smoke, there's fire. In the lake, there's neither. Okay, that's only the third step. Fourth step. One should apply the reason to the specific situation at hand. Okay, I gave a general principle, but what I want to prove is that there's fire here, not that there's fire somewhere. I have to prove that my thesis is there's fire right here on this mountain. So I have to apply my general rule to the specific situation. Not a hard thing to do. You just say, smoke is rising from this particular mountain. I have my general rule, where there's smoke, there's fire. Next thing is, oh, well, right here, on this mountain, there's smoke. That's the fourth step. Fifth step, one should draw the conclusion. Therefore, this mountain is on fire. That's the basic procedure. The essential element in this kind of inference is the reason, the hetu, which in real life is drawn from experience. From the experience of seeing smoke together with fire, in many places, including kitchens, one makes an induction. I'm sorry, I called it inference. It's induction. Inference is general. All kinds of logic. Induction means you presume a general rule from a lot of experience. One makes an induction, a presumption by generalization. It is always possible for an inductive premise to turn out wrong. But absolute certainty from logic is possible only in abstract realms like geometry, not in real life. The purpose of insisting that in a formal argument an example be given is to ensure that the reason is based on reality. Abstract systems of logic can accept as true an empty statement such as all square triangles are red. Because there's no case of a square triangle that isn't red. If you have a square triangle that isn't red, that invalidates the inference. But it's not invalidated, so it has to be accepted as true. All square triangles are red. Nyaya Anuman, however, demands that the terms and propositions used in logical arguments refer to things that exist. Okay, it's 11 o'clock. We're supposed to stop. One or two questions. Yes.
Abstract logic where you could say all square triangles are red.
Yeah. That's so a valid inference.
Yeah, it's a modern logic and Buddhist logic.
Yes, the Buddhists have that kind of abstract logic too.
Because
there is no concrete reality populated by things for the Buddhists, so they have to use only abstract logic. The whole world is abstract for them.
I'm just wondering what practical use is there of such kind of logic?
You can use it to build nuclear weapons, and the whole all technology of modern world is based on that abstract logic. Modern science and technology.
For example, like how?
Well, it's not that, you know, the
Einstein and his friends were puttering around the laboratory mixing various things out of bottles and boom, you know, they made an atomic bomb by mistake. It didn't just happen, but they were playing with their mathematical formulas, drawing various inferences, and they discovered, you know, if we put enough of these molecules, these unstable molecules together, if we pack them in close enough and put enough of them there, they're going to make a really big explosion. And they just figured that all out by their abstract logic. And then, you know, Albert Einstein wrote a letter to President Roosevelt saying, hey, you know, we could build a bomb to blow up, you know, the whole city at once. But it all came from abstract logic, mathematical logic. They were just playing with mathematics. And they came up with this, you know, if we assume this mathematically and we draw a conclusion, we could blow up the whole world. Yeah. Well, abstract logic can have a practical connection. It's karyak shama. It gets things done. Even though it's based on a fiction, it's a useful fiction. Because we don't say it's a fiction. We say that, you know, that there is reality and real logic should deal with the reality directly. But if you're an idealist and you think that there's nothing real, it's just energy, and the energy is always changing, still you can do practical things with the energy with your illusory logic. You can pretend there's, you know, you can pretend that you've got, you know, 100 grams of plutonium and you can figure out what to do with it, even though it's just a fiction. You can use that fiction to blow yourself up. You're just a fiction anyway. What does it matter? Well, no, but square triangle is an absurdity. We have different levels of unreality. Square triangle is a lot more unreal than 100 grams of plutonium. You can throw all the square triangles at me that you want. It's not going to do any damage. But if you get your hands on 100 grams of plutonium, you might be able to blow up the whole city. It's you know, dream reality is less real than public reality. Public reality is also illusion, of course, according to the impersonalists, the Buddhists and the Mayavadis. What everybody sees in this world, the life we're living, is all illusion. But it's a shared illusion. And, you know, life goes on. You know, the illusion has its practical effects. We have wars, we have famines, and things go on, and people live and die. All an illusion, but it happens on an illusory level of pretend reality. But then there's something that's even more unreal. That's the dreams you have at night. Everybody has their own dreams and they have their own logic. But sometimes a person, you know, has a heart attack in his dream and dies. He gets so scared in his dream he dies. So there's some reality in a dream. And then even less real than that is the world of square triangles, which has no effect. Just to drive some people crazy because they're, you know, meditating on square triangles. But they have no practical effect. So, the practical unreality of everyday life is less unreal than the absurdities like square triangles and rabbit's horns. Even for the Mayavadis. They talk about different levels of unreality. So, ordinary logic... For the Buddhists, they use logic as a useful fiction to deal with the practical world. To explain how a living entity can realize the absolute truth. Problem is, for the Buddhists, there is no such thing as a living entity. There is no individual soul. So you're going to be dealing on a fictional level when you're telling an individual how to become self-realized. It's a fiction that he's an individual in the first place. But just to get that person liberated, go ahead and pretend he's a real person and give him some practical things to do, it works. The individual dissolves, emerges into nirvana, and everything's fine. At least that's what they try to do. They try to use logic for practical, for what they think is practical purposes. Like attaining nirvana. Yes. This is the last question. We're over time.
So we have to give an example for every of our statement which we make in according to this steps of logic. But we may not see all possible things or whatever in this world, because our experience is limited and we didn't see everything. And if somebody tell us some abstract things, maybe it really exists, we just didn't experience it, we just didn't know. For example, it may exist not on this planet, but on some higher planetary systems. But we may state that I didn't see it, I didn't realize it, and therefore it's not a reality, therefore I cannot accept it, but actually it may be real.
Okay, so but if the reality is beyond the scope of my perception, it's on some higher world or someplace, then my pratyaksha and my anuman are not going to be able to access it. Shabda Brahman can tell me what's going on in other worlds. People from higher planets can tell me, and I can accept their authority. Or the Vedas can tell me about things going on all different planets. But that has to be by Shabda Brahman. That I can only by Shabda Brahman can I access realms of reality that are beyond the scope of my other pramanas.
But for example, in the case of this square triangle, we can also imagine something like, I don't know how to show it.
You mean a world where there are square triangles?
Yeah, we can imagine that it may exist. I can draw the
okay,
draw
but those who worship such a world, they'll go there. It's not a triangle anymore. How many sides? How many sides does it have? No, it's not a triangle. It's a square. It's a rectangle. That's a quadrilateral.
But we can call it triangle, and we can call it
triangle
square
inside.
Time.
No, that's different. There's a triangle inside it.
but what I want to mean in this, that we cannot understand this this conception. Somebody will tell us that this exists, but we can interpret it in different way. But he, for example, he wanted to express himself in different way, and we cannot understand.
Oh, okay, but the thing is, it's a standard term, triangle. We accept, you know, everybody who studied geometry. Even today, they take Euclid as the founder of geometry, and he defined what a triangle is. He created the word. Maybe he didn't, but he made it a scientific term. He said a triangle has three sides. It's a plane figure with three sides and three angles. So if I can't just go ahead and change the definition, three sides, but sometimes four. You know, we're following Euclid. He defined what the word was. It's a created word. As a scientific term, it's created by Euclid. And I can't play around with it. I can't change the definition. Then you deal, you know, if you play with language like that, then you're talking about something else. You're not talking about the same thing anymore.
And also, it's a little bit different subject. About, for example, Mayavadi said that Maya is not real and not unreal. We can tell, okay, but we don't have any experience of something in this world which is at the same time real and not real. So is it a good example that we cannot accept their conception of Maya because it has no proofs in our reality?
Yes. But there's nothing to compare it to that's real. You know, you can't. All experience says that something has to be real or not real. It can't be both or neither.
But
and they're proposing something that's neither real or not real. You know, well, give me an example of such a thing, and there is no example.
But at the same time, we may also follow this logic that our experience is limited and we have to accept Shabda Pramana, and they may quote so many Shastras in order to prove their conceptions, and they may tell, okay, your experience is limited, you cannot give example of these things which are real and unreal at the same time, but Shabda tells that it's possible, therefore you have to accept it.
Does Shabda tell us?
I'm not sure. They may bring so many statements from Upanishads.
Well, okay, but yeah. I think we have to cut it short. It's 10 after. Our understanding of the scriptures has to be according to the interpretation of a proper authority. They're misinterpreting the Vedas, and we can show. We can show that they're illicitly misinterpreting, intentionally misinterpreting the Vedas, and therefore we can dismiss their interpretations. I don't think we have time to do that right now. Okay, well, but that's the Vaishnavacharyas go to great lengths to show that the logic, the reasoning of the Mayavadis is invalid, and therefore they should not be accepted as authorities. Not only because we disagree with them, but because they're illogical. They contradict themselves. But we don't have time to show that. Later on, Jiva Goswami will discuss that. When we get to the third, when we get two-thirds way through this Tattvasandarbha, he'll be discussing that. The illogical inconsistencies in the Mayavad theory. Okay? I thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Shri Tattva Sandarbha Ki Jai. We're a very targeted audience.